Welcome back. In this lecture, we turn to the Mediterranean Sea for the first time, and to some of the earliest cultures that flourished in the geographic region that today we call Greece. But these civilizations actually predate true Greek civilization. Now, we know a lot about Greek culture from about 750 BC onwards. And the reason for that is because it's from that time that the first written documents survive, those that we can read fluently at least. But up until the 20th century, Greek history before 750 BC was almost non-existent. And the only information we had were Greek myths, fantastic stories that the later Greeks told about those earlier times. One of these myths was the story of King Minos, who lived on the island of Crete. And to validate Minos's claim to the throne, the gods sent to him a beautiful bull. Minos was so awed by the beauty of this bull that he failed to sacrifice it to the gods as he should have done. In revenge, the gods caused Minos's wife, Pasiphae, to fall in love with the bull. Well, she, shall we say, managed to consummate her lust for this animal, and as a result, gave birth to a monster with the body of a man and the head of a bull, known as the Minotaur. King Minos, who was understandably embarrassed by his wife's illegitimate mutant offspring, then constructed a maze in the basement of his palace called the Labyrinth. And into this maze, he threw the creature and occasionally tossed in a few virgins to feed it. Well, in 1899, an English aristocrat named Sir Arthur Evans became obsessed with the idea that there was a historical basis for this seemingly fantastic myth. And as a result, he traveled to Crete, and being a rather rich Englishman, he was able to hire a bunch of locals and just start digging around. Everybody thought he was crazy, but to everyone's amazement, he actually uncovered the remains of a large palace-like structure in which there were numerous depictions of bulls and bulls' horns, and most amazingly of all, there was what appeared to be a labyrinth or maze in the basement. As a result of Evans' archaeological discoveries and others that followed after it, we've learned that there were indeed significant major civilizations in the geographic region of Greece prior to 750 BC. Now, we don't actually know what these civilizations called themselves, but modern historians have labeled the two most important of them the Minoans, after mythical King Minos, and the Mycenaeans, after Mycenae, which was one of the largest cities of that culture. In the lecture on Indus Valley Civilization, we saw how hard it is to interpret a culture when all that survives is material archaeological evidence. And we encounter exactly the same problem with Minoan civilization. So, let's see what archaeology can tell us about the Minoans. Minoan civilization seems to have begun flourishing and building its large urban centers around 2000 BC on the island of Crete. And over the next 600 years, it spreads to pretty much all the other islands in the Aegean Sea. So Minoan civilization is almost exclusively an island-based civilization. That first city, which was excavated and found by Evans, is known as Knossos, and it turned out to be the largest of all the Minoan centers. Another major Minoan site was located on the island of Thera. Today, that island is called Santorini, and includes the city of Akrotiri. And there are a couple Minoan enclaves or outposts on the mainland of Greece, but they're much smaller, so they're really just confined to the islands of the Aegean. In almost all cases, Minoan palace structures share certain characteristics. They have dozens of interconnected rooms clumped together in a fairly disorganized fashion. But always, at the center of Minoan palaces is a large central open courtyard. Another very interesting thing is that there do not appear to be walls or fortifications around Minoan cities. and very, very few weapons have been found. And with a single exception, their art does not seem to depict warfare. Now, let's say you're an archaeologist. You've just uncovered these various facts. What could you infer about the civilization, then, based on these things? Well, one obvious interpretation would be that this was a peaceful society, that neither fought amongst themselves nor had dangerous external enemies. And indeed, there are those scholars who have very much emphasized this idea and have portrayed the Minoans as a peaceful, almost idyllic people. Another possible reading of the evidence is that the Minoans possessed a very powerful navy, which dominated the eastern Mediterranean, and so they had no need for walls around their cities. They stopped enemies before they ever got that far. In the rooms of these palaces, the walls are often covered with very attractive painted frescoes. And these frescoes are one of our best sources to knowing about the culture of the people who live there. And the frescoes show people engaged often in what today we would call leisure activities. So we see young men boxing and competing in athletics. There's paintings of women who are wearing very elaborate makeup, have these expensive but kind of comfortable looking robes, and lots of jewelry and fancy hairdos piled up atop their heads. A large number of these frescoes depict scenes from nature, and we have highly realistic portraits of birds, fish, and animals. The Minoans were clearly a seafaring people, so there's many nautical scenes of people fishing and sailing around in ships. And obviously the Minoans were accomplished sailors who traveled much of the Mediterranean buying and selling their goods. For example, we know that the Minoans had trade links with ancient Egypt. Egyptian goods have been found in Minoan cities, and distinctively Minoan products have been found in Egypt. Also, some have argued that Minoan art displays a very strong Egyptian influence. This was also clearly a wealthy civilization. Minoan palaces usually include storerooms on the ground level containing things called pithoi. These are giant clay pots, sometimes 5 feet tall, that are stuffed with food goods, grain, olive oil, and wine. By the way, the labyrinth apparently found by Evans actually turned out to be these storerooms in the basement of Knossos. A major debate centers around Minoan religion. And here, archaeology starts to fail us. Obviously, a bull was an important symbol to them. We see bulls in frescoes, we find bull sculptures, and probably the single most ubiquitous symbol in Minoan sites is stylized depiction of bull's horns. Probably the most famous fresco shows a group of young men and women grabbing the horns of bulls and then vaulting acrobatically over their backs. But again, whether this is just some form of entertainment or sport, or maybe a religious ritual, we don't know. A statue that was found at Knossos that's well known shows a bare-breasted woman with very elaborate and expensive clothing, with her arms outstretched, holding two snakes. And a lot has been written about this statue. Some have interpreted it as a depiction of a goddess. Others think she's a priestess. But again, without written interpretation, we don't know for sure. The apparently peaceful nature of the Minoans, the depiction of women in art, and lots of women in art, and objects such as this statue have led to some to speculate that maybe women held positions of power in Minoan society. But again, this has to remain hypothetical. The Minoans did have a system of writing. So there are clay tablets, which archaeologists have found, inscribed with a script. And the language does not seem to be related to Greek, and it's been labeled Linear A. There's been some partial decipherment of it, but we really can't read Linear A very well, and so we don't know what the Minoans wrote about themselves. Unfortunately, for the Minoans, the islands that they lived on were prone to natural disasters. Creeks, was frequently struck by major earthquakes, and these would flatten large sections of Knossos. But each time after evidence of this destruction, it looks like the city was then rebuilt. A more unique disaster struck around 1500 BC. The island of Thera was, at that time, almost a perfect circle in shape. And any time you see a perfectly circular island, that should maybe suggest something a bit troubling. As you might guess, Thera turned out to really be the top part of the cone of an enormous volcano. And around 1500, this volcano exploded in a truly cataclysmic eruption. The entire middle section of Thera literally just blew up and flew away. So that when you go to the island today, it no longer looks like a circle, but instead, it resembles the letter C. And one, fortunate aspect of the eruption, at least from our perspective, is that the Minoan city of Akrotiri, which was on the very edge of the island, was buried in mud and thus was preserved. And it's very much like a Minoan version of Pompeii. Incidentally, Santorini, as Thera is called today, is one of the absolutely most beautiful, spectacular of all the Greek islands. If you go to Santorini, you'll actually sail right into the volcanic crater, and it looms around you on every side, and the main town perches up on the rim of the crater. And you can still take a boat out to an island in the middle of the crater, which is still smoking and volcanically active. So it's a nice place to go if you ever visit Greece. The tidal waves from this eruption devastated a lot of Minoan centers on other islands, including seemingly Crete. And the memory of the destruction of Thera seems to have been passed down verbally over many generations. Over 1,000 years later, the Greek philosopher Plato wrote down an account of a story he had heard in which he describes a sophisticated, complex island civilization which at some point in the distant past flourished until the island was abruptly destroyed in a great natural disaster. Now, Plato didn't know the true name of that civilization, so he invented a name, and he called this island Atlantis. And while there's many debates about this, a lot of scholars, and this is a theory I kind of inclined to myself, suspect that the origins, the historical kernel of truth at the basis of the Atlantis myth, may well be found in the destruction of Thera. By 1200 BC about, Minoan civilization seems to have collapsed. The population plummeted, cities are abandoned, and in some cases they show signs of violent destruction, of being burnt. Now, whether the collapse of Minoan civilization was due to maybe external invaders, internal dissension, ecological or natural disaster, maybe some combination of all of those, it remains unknown. So, just like Indus Valley civilization, all that we have remaining today of what was once clearly a powerful, wealthy, sophisticated culture is some fairly enigmatic ruins. The second important pre-Greek civilization that I want to talk about today was not centered on the islands, but instead on the mainland of Greece. And today we call the civilization Mycenaeans. And this term gives a little bit of a false impression that they were one united nation. In reality, the Mycenaeans were dozens of separate, tiny, little independent kingdoms that all shared a similar culture and language. Since the largest of these cities was Mycenae, we collectively call them the Mycenaeans, but they're not a single unified political entity. Mycenaean civilization gets started a little bit later than the Minoans, around, let's say, 1600 BC. And some of the major cities are Mycenae, Tiryns, and Pylos. And all of those are located on the Peloponnesus, which is the southern half of the Greek mainland. And the Mycenaeans form a nice pair with the Minoans because in many ways they're almost opposites of one another. So, whereas Minoan cities are characterized by openness, luxury, and a complete lack of fortifications. If we look at Mycenaean cities, we find that they are extremely heavily fortified, and their culture seems to have been dominated by military concerns. Mycenaean cities are almost always located in positions that are highly defensible, usually a hilltop, and always they're surrounded by absolutely gigantic walls. I've been in tiny Mycenaean cities that are only 100 feet across, but they'll have a huge 20-foot-high wall around them. And the largest Mycenaean cities can have walls that are 40 feet thick at the base and really just tower over the buildings inside them. Some of the blocks of stone at Mycenae itself measure 18 by 14 feet and weigh over 100 tons. In fact, when the later Greeks discovered these Mycenaean sites, they were so amazed by the sheer size of the walls that they assumed that these cities must have been built by a race of giants, such as the legendary Cyclops. And so even today, this type of fortification is called a Cyclopean wall. In these Mycenaean cities, we do not find any nice, airy central courtyards like in Minoan cities. Instead, they cluster around an enclosed throne room called a megaron. And just overall, Mycenaean cities are kind of smaller, darker, and grimmer than Minoan ones. Whereas Minoan art shows peaceful scenes of nature and people at play, almost all Mycenaean art shows battle or hunting scenes. In addition, Mycenaean art shows a much greater sort of concern in its aesthetics with symmetry and order. And this is sometimes interpreted as being symbolic of or reflecting a society maybe that is run along the structured lines of a military organization. If the bull was the favorite animal or emblem of the Minoans, when we turn to Mycenaean art, we find their favorite animal is the lion. And as we've seen in other cultures like the Assyrians, lions are often associated with warlike activities or warlike cultures. The main entrance to Mycenae is a gate that's called the Lion Gate because right above it is a sculpture of two lions. And a lot of the best evidence for Mycenaean civilization comes from its tombs, which have been excavated. And the earliest of these tombs were actually inside the city's walls. And this is very unusual. Most people bury their dead outside the city walls. But this suggests that maybe even the dead in Mycenae weren't safe from raiders, so they had to be buried actually within the walls. And when these tombs were excavated, archaeologists found very, very rich grave goods. The corpses were buried with gold jewelry and these famous gold death masks. Also suggesting the warlike nature of the Mycenaeans is the fact that in the tombs were weapons of every imaginable sort. Bronze swords, daggers, armor, and a helmet that was made out of the tusks of boars. The general or overall impression we get of Mycenaean culture then is of lots of little city-states, each one ruled over by a local warlord who were constantly fighting with their neighbors. And the territory owned by each city-state was pretty small. And I think here again we see geography and topography playing a role in culture. So unlike Mesopotamia, Egypt, or India, or China, where you have big, extensive flatlands which encourage large empires, Greece is extremely mountainous, and so it encourages smallish political entities. In fact, almost the entire mainland of Greece consists of small valleys surrounded, each one, by rocky hills. And it's often very hard to cross the hills and go from one valley to another. So in Greece, it's hard to conquer and hold a large amount of territory. So, by geographic determinism, each little valley tends to be its own separate political entity. And down the road, this geographic pattern will have really profound implications for why Greece ends up developing so many new political ideas. The other important thing to remember about Greece's geography is that no matter where you are in Greece, you're always close to the sea. In fact, I think the statistic is that 72% of the land area of Greece is within 25 miles of a shoreline. What this does is it predisposes the Greeks to be sailors. And they tend to look to the sea when they have to move or expand, because it's simply much easier to hop in a boat and sail someplace than to struggle over those mountains even to the next little valley. Archaeologists have found clay tablets which are inscribed with a writing system used by the Mycenaeans. And scholars have labeled this, not very creatively, Linear B. There's about 4,000 of these clay tablets. But just as with Minoan Linear A, initially nobody could read them. A breakthrough in that came in 1952. When a young English architect, kind of out of the blue, announced that he had deciphered Linear B. And to everyone's amazement, he turned out to be right. His name was Michael Ventris, and even from birth, this seemed to be a person who had a gift with languages. For example, by the time he was 6, he could speak English, French, German, a Germanic dialect, and Polish. And when he was just 14 years old, he attended a lecture given by the by then very old Sir Arthur Evans, and from that point on, even though he became an architect, he was fascinated with Linear B, and he spent all of his spare time trying to decipher it. Linear B turned out to be a direct precursor to Greek, at least phonetically, the way it sounded. But it used a different alphabet. And the decipherment of Linear B, really, when this was announced, raised hopes that now we would learn much more about these people. We would learn about their history, their beliefs, all those things that written text can tell us. Unfortunately, and remember here, back to the first lecture on Mesopotamia and what people first used writing for when they discovered it, well, it was the same thing here. Unfortunately, when all these tablets were read, it turned out that almost every one of them was simply a list of objects or land ownership records. In other words, they were tax documents. There were no histories and no literature. Now, the lists of objects are amazingly detailed, to such a degree that one tablet lists even items that no longer work, such as a broken wheel. And we have another one that records the name of an individual cow. Now, in the rest of the tablets, there are almost no names of people. So the irony is, while we know the name of a Mycenaean cow, we don't know the name of a single Mycenaean king. And I think there's definitely a lesson to be learned here about you should record what really matters to you. Great things were expected of the young Michael Ventris after this amazing decipherment, but unfortunately, he was not able to enjoy his achievement for very long, since right afterwards he died in a highway crash at the age of 34. Mycenaean civilization, like that of the Minoans, also eventually collapses. The fate of Mycenaean cities often seems to have been a violent one. So between about 1200 BC and 1100, almost every major Mycenaean site shows evidence of having been destroyed and burnt. So this civilization met a violent end. And ironically, it's only because of this destruction that those Linear B tablets survive, because the fires literally bake the clay tablets, causing them to harden and thus preserving them for later archaeologists. With the collapse of Mycenaean civilization, Greece enters an era which is called the Greek Dark Ages, or the Greek Dark Age, and it lasts about 1200 to 800 BC. They're called the Dark Ages because civilization, remember meaning cities, almost entirely disappears. So it just goes back to small little individual farms. Nobody's quite sure what caused the destruction of these cities, although there's a lot of speculation that nomadic invaders may have come down from the north and played a role in this. In Greece, during this period, there do seem to have been several groups of people who migrated in and intermingled with the locals. One of these was a group called the Dorians, and for a long time scholars talked about the Dorian invasion as having caused the fall of the Mycenaeans. More recently, as with the so-called Aryan invasions in India, this has been seen as probably a bit of an oversimplification. But it is clear that in the Dark Ages, the population of Greece plummeted. We know, for example, that in the 13th century BC, there were 320 occupied sites in Greece. In the 12th century, that number falls to only 130 sites, and by about 1000 BC, there are only 40 remaining occupied sites in Greece. So a catastrophic population decline. Communication ceases, and nobody is really traveling around anymore at all. Also at this time, trade seems to have dried up, and everything just reverts to little scattered family farms where people are just scratching out a subsistence level of living. How bad are things in the Greek Dark Ages? Even pottery, and pottery is always a nice gauge of the material prosperity of a culture, even pottery gets ugly in this period. Mycenaean pottery had been nicely well made with all sorts of nice decorations, but now it just turns into these sort of black pots and often misshapen. After 1100, the style of pottery that dominates is called sub-Mycenaean, and as that name sort of implies, it's a lot inferior in quality and decoration. Worst of all, in the Greek Dark Ages, the very ability to write was forgotten. One of the greatest advances of civilization simply vanishes. And that's about all I can tell you about the Dark Ages, because almost no evidence of any sort survives from this period. It really is a lost time. But around 1000 BC, for reasons that no one's really sure of, things start to gradually improve. A new style of pottery emerges between 1000 and 800 called proto-geometric, which, again, as the name suggests, has very nice little geometric patterns on it. And finally, around the 8th century BC, the population starts to rapidly increase. When that happens, cities begin to form again, and we finally end up with a new, very highly decorated form of pottery called geometric. People begin to travel from place to place, merchants start to transport and sell goods, everything starts to get better. Most importantly of all, writing is rediscovered. Now, spoken Greek had remained pretty much the same, both before and after the Dark Ages. But since the written language of Linear B had been forgotten, the Greeks now had to come up with a new form of writing. Well, instead of inventing a new alphabet, they took a much easier path, and they simply stole an existing one. So what they did is they took a script, a set of letters used by the Phoenicians, and the Greeks now simply assigned the sounds of spoken Greek to various Phoenician letters, and sort of adapted others as necessary. This new written language is what we now term ancient Greek, and a lot of the letters in that alphabet would eventually find their way into our own alphabet. As the Phoenician alphabet, remember, was itself derived from the alphabets of the ancient Near East, you now have a continuous chain linking the very first alphabets of Mesopotamia to modern English and to other modern languages. Finally, around 776 BC, the first Olympic Games are held. And I think maybe more than anything else, that is a nice symbol that Greece had finally and fully emerged from the Dark Ages. And from this point on, we can truly speak of Greek history rather than pre-Greek cultures such as the Minoans and the Mycenaeans. This lecture, and indeed many of the ones before it, have been filled with a lot of qualified statements. I keep saying it appears, or it seems that, or we think. But now, we've finally entered the true historical era, and a time when our knowledge of peoples and events becomes much more concrete. So, before we launch into the history of the Greeks and the Mediterranean, though, I want to briefly look backwards in the next lecture at the fundamental works of Greek literature that were formed during the Dark Age and which we ascribe to the figure known as Homer. And furthermore, I want to compare Homer's epics to the great literary tradition of Vedic India. Thank you.